amazing weather. I have been in Australia for about 25 years. I know it doesn't sound like it, but I haven't done much of this accent. Hopefully you can understand the American accent. I often start these presentations with a bit of a Japanese proverb that I've adapted, which says something like, strategy without execution is a bit of a daydream, and execution without strategy is a nightmare. But either without leadership doesn't really exist. And my career has followed that path. I started in strategy for a long-forgotten company, Already Foods, which was bought by PwC recently. I had no idea, with all due respect to the PwC people in the room, why they did that, but that's interesting. So Foods was where I started. And after a while, strategy was kind of frustrating because I wanted to do something. So what better place to do something than actually really get involved in the Sydney Olympics, which I did for 4 years, and directed the operational planning for those venues. And boy, oh boy, once you do that, it's hard to come back in normal life. But I really, really learned how you translate strategy into execution. And then what I learned in the last year of the Olympics is how people bring them together. And I watched some of my teams really rise, and I watched some of the teams absolutely crash, according to how strong their leadership was. And I became a fascinating student of leadership since that point. And I've been following it ever since. So since 2000, I have had multiple ways of experiencing and exploring leadership. And one of the things that hopefully you guys get a chance to do from time to time is look back and go, oh, I know why I studied that. And one of the things I studied was biology and did all kinds of experiments on rats to induce anxiety in the rats, which I do pay for karmically from time to time. But it still has always made me fascinated with the brain and the way our bodies work. And I do think with the modern science and technology that exists now, we're learning so much about the brain. And it's fun to be able to use it in leadership and work with executives to help them understand maybe a little bit what's happening with the stresses that we're facing, and hopefully it'll help you as well. So we'll give it a shot tonight. I'm pretty easy at stopping. You'll see that I get people to talk a lot, so just pause. I'm very relaxed. So let me start with fearless leadership, or neuroscience meets leadership. And I always start with this quote with Robert Frost, because for me, leadership is synonymous with conscious choice. And I like Robert Frost's poem, which always reminds us that we're always making choices in our leadership. And it's the brain that allows us to do that. Now, I haven't, let's talk about why fear exists, right? For those of you who got involved, I'm sure it would have been interesting on the insurance side to be involved with this. I happen to be at Commonwealth Bank working to determine how we could cover or not cover Queensland floods at the time. So it was really tragic and interesting time to be there. But this is why the brain needs to operate. It is a fear-induced environment. The brain needs to know how to operate. So does it need to operate in Christchurch when this kind of stuff happens? So does it need to happen in Japan when the tsunami happens or the aftermath of the nuclear reaction happens? We need our brain to be able to tell us when a life and death situation exists. And it's very good at that. It always has been. The reason you're sitting there here today is because your ancestors were phenomenally good at picking up what life and death looks like, and they were phenomenally good at surviving. But the interesting bit is our brains haven't evolved much since our ancestors were cavemen, and they're very jumpy. We see life and death situations in everything. And these headlines, by the way, haven't changed. I haven't changed this particular slide since 2008, and it's now 2014, and we haven't changed since 2008. I remember it quite clearly. If anybody's here from Macquarie Bank, I can remember the day where a couple of weeks after Lehman Brothers collapsed, and Macquarie dropped, I think it was 500 people out into the street of Sydney. It was just absolute mayhem, lost jobs. It was absolute chaos. But the headlines haven't changed, and so we constantly see fear in our workplaces, and I'm fascinated with how we are starting to cope with that. One of the reasons I went back to study psychotherapy a couple of years ago, or now it's probably 10, was the amount of depression and anxiety that I see in executives that are behind the facade, and I'm fascinated why it is that we live with such depression and anxiety. And look, it doesn't have to be as dire as this, because frankly, when I walk around many of the corporates that I've been involved with, when I have been inside CBA and I've been inside TBE, for example, and the many other corporates I've worked with as a consultant, these are the type of pictures I see. And, this is not abnormal. And the stress and the anxiety that we're facing in corporate life is a big concern to me. I would say if the ratio is right, that one out of three of you are probably on antidepressants by the ratio, and it may go up, and I'll explain serotonin in a little bit more time. At least the executive ranks of it, and it's going up. And maybe even two out of three in the next couple of years. It's a very interesting statistic, and that's just normal. And what I'm going to argue here is that fear for us is actually false evidence appearing real. We constantly see life and death situations in the most normal work situations, and our brain, my hypothesis here, is our brains aren't sophisticated enough to separate that. So let's talk a little bit about a model that we'll work through over the next hour, and we'll finish it at 7 and people can stay around and ask questions and stuff like that. So the model I want to take you through is, number one, let's go first talk about what it is that triggers us in believing in a normal workday situation that we're having a life and death problem. Number two, let's try to understand when we're in autopilot, how we actually respond on automatically. And for those of you know, it's a fight, flight, and freeze response. Some of us go straight to aggression, some of us flee the scene, some of us just freeze and comply. In 2008, that's all I saw was comply, comply, but I'm putting my head down, I don't want to, I'm not going to cause any fuss, I just need to keep my job. There was enormous amounts of fear. And it hasn't completely changed yet. And it's interesting, when we go into autopilot, our first response is this. But the interesting thing is, we can make a choice not to go through that response. And the neuroscientists tell us that it takes 0.3 of a second to get a stimulus that looks like a life or death threat from our subconscious to our conscious mind, and then it takes about 0.2 of a second to choose consciously what to do with that stimulus. In other words, we don't have to go to this. We can do this. The problem is, most of our leaders, most of ourselves, are mostly trapped to this all day long, and it's really fascinating to watch. And I'll take you through that in a minute. And the reason behind that is we don't have mind fitness in our society. We have a lot of physical fitness, we're interested in physical fitness, but we're not particularly adept at understanding the brain. And interestingly, the more that I study some of the more ancient philosophies like Buddhism and some of the Hinduism and some of the old Christianity and some of our other religions, Judaism, they knew thousands of years ago. They've been trying to teach us for thousands of years, but as a society, we had forgotten. And now the science is coming around to proving that aspects of that, I don't say everything about it, is true. And this is the most fascinating for all of us. So let me go through the model one at a time. So let's go a little bit about the brain. So the brain. If you wanted to just say the brain has three parts, you can make it really simple. You could say the oldest part of the evolutionary system in our brain is called the reptilian part of our brain. It really is from our backbone all the way up to here. And it's what is regulating your temperature right now. You don't have to think about your temperature. You don't have to think about your heart rate. You don't even have to think about your breathing rate. Your reptilian part of your brain is doing that for you right this minute. That's handy. The middle part of your brain is the limbic part of your brain, or the mammalian part of your brain. That was the second part of our brain to evolve. That's where we do a lot of our routines. So if you're a great tennis player, all your forehand and your backhand and your serve are all saved down there. You don't have to think about it. That's where we have a lot of the emotions and the memories that we often that erupt in the middle of somewhere that's surprising. That's where a lot of the emotional part of the brain that's very important. But what's the most interesting part in our story tonight is these two little things called the amygdala. And the amygdala are like the little red olive-shaped parts. And the amygdala are what actually are little choice points, because they'll take the data in from the outside. They'll say, is this a life and death threat? And if it's a life and death threat, they'll enact a response. And if it's not, they'll send the information slowly around to the most evolved third part of the brain, which is the cortex. And the cortex for human beings, particularly the prefrontal cortex here, is of all animals in our kingdom on this earth, we are the most evolved right here, the prefrontal cortex. So this is where, right here, we do our calm, collected, actuarial type of thinking. So this is where we make rational decisions, where we think well. And what's interesting about this part of the brain is it's known by the neuroscientists as the Goldilocks part of the brain, because it has to have everything right. It gets so easily distracted, and we're going to talk about those distractions, but it's very difficult for us to stay in this all day long, this part, prefrontal cortex. So, Daniel Goleman, who wrote the book The Emotional Intelligence, coined this term, the amygdala hijack, for when we get upset. Okay, so he says, scientists say, he just coined the term. Data comes in to the thalamus, which is part of the limbic system. The data is sent to the amygdala. And then from the amygdala, if the amygdala says, you know what, it's not a life and death threat, fine, send the information, actually rather slowly, by the way, to the cortex. And the cortex will make some kind of calm decisions about what's going on. However, if the amygdala says it's a life and death threat, the signal gets blocked here, and the signal goes down into your reptilian part of your system to get you into fight, flight, or freeze. And what happens is all of your glucose has to go to your extremities. So your reptilian part sends your glucose to the extremities. Well, how do you do that? Because you have to raise your heart to get your blood pumped out to that. Your blood pressure has to go up, and your breathing rate goes up. And that's our normal response to a threat, life and death threat. And it's interesting, anybody been in a near-term car accident? Near car accident. Anybody? Yeah. What happened? Tell me about it. Speak nice and loudly.
I was driving onto the Harbour Bridge at North Sydney.
Yep.
So I went to Omran, and my back tire split out.
Yeah.
So I fishtailed down the Omran between a concrete wall.
Yeah, and what happened? Did you were you able to respond quickly?
Yeah, I got it straight into the car.
Yeah.
And it freaked out, but you can't pull over until flee.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but did you feel like you were going into another part of your brain that was taking over?
Yeah.
Okay. Did anybody have a near-death experience, sort of like that?
I've sat in a chair and then, like, leaned back sometimes. Yeah. And, you know, like, sometimes, like, goes too far back. And you basically think, like, you're about to die.
Interesting. Well, my near-death experience, well, I've had a few, actually. But one of them was, I was in my father's SUV, driving on the right side of the road, so I'm in Boston. Driving on the right side of the road, and somewhere out of the superior female peripheral vision, males have better target vision, we have better peripheral vision. So out of my superior peripheral vision, I sensed somehow that a meth truck was bearing down on my side of the truck, side of my SUV, and my kids were in the back. And if I'd used my prefrontal cortex, which is very clever, but it's very slow, to work out the response to that, I would have been dead. They would have been dead. No, no problem. But the thing is, these guys are very handy, and these are very handy. So you're in a life and death thing. We're just going to put pump blood to your thing, and you're just going to pull over and let the truck go. And that's how, you know, that's how it works. That's how it works when you stick your finger on the stove. Your nigga says, yeah, no, out. Before you even get it, the signal to hear. We like the amygdala. It keeps us alive. The problem with it, though, is this. It's overactive. And so what do you guys call that? It's error one or error two. But it's overactive. It sees life and death everywhere. And a colleague of mine who's been working with leadership and neuroscience for many, many years, and I would recommend his book called The Brain at Work, David Rock, coined a term, SARP. Or what are the stimuli that actually send us into life and death responses at work? So, SAR stands for five things. The first one is status. Every single one of us, human beings, even the most Buddhist of them all, is a creature of status. And when we expect to receive a certain amount of status and we don't get that status in response, we are liable to have an amygdala hijack. I particularly like watching meetings of executives, and I'll try to get there just a little bit before everybody does. Because what I really enjoy watching is everybody coming in and sort of sussing out the room and trying to figure out where they are on the totem pole to figure out how they're going to actually play in the meeting. And if they get the same amount of time of voice and respect that they think they should have gotten, then they're okay. If they don't, they'll have an amygdala hijack, I guarantee it. But it's interesting because men have a way of sussing out the room like this. They would do this to their pants. And I haven't figured out what the women's response is, how the women do it. The men do it like that. So you'll have to explain that to me one day. It has something to do with status and pecking order, and I'm just not even going to go with that.
Okay.
So status is a big deal, and you guys know that. Think about your companies, and I'm going to get you to think about them in a minute. But I love watching companies like CBA and QB. I mean, who's got which office? Who's got parking down on the stairs? What are the titles? Who's got such and such on their business card? Who can speak to whom? Status is everything, and it drives us nuts. The next one, certainty. We go toward a car, and we expect that the car is going to open with a flick of a key, and instead we're confronted by a key code. That's a mistake in our brain. That is not a pattern that we recognize. Our brain will actually recognize it as a mistake, and if it's a mistake that's abrupt enough, we're liable to go, can't work this out. Now that's a bit of a silly example in some ways, but you'd be surprised at how little it takes to do an amygdala hijack. For those of you who are trying to do a new exercise regime, or a new food regime, or coming and moving to a whole different country. Just speaking to a couple of people that have come from different countries. I mean, that is huge for many, many weeks, many months perhaps. You're probably, you know, going, how do you figure this country out called Australia? I don't even know. When you move to a different city, it's like that. We crave certainty, and the leader's job in work is to give people as much certainty as they can. So they need to be able, even if they don't know themselves, we're going left around the mountain. That's what we're going to do. We're going to go left around the mountain. So you know, we're going left around the mountain, not right, left. However, what's interesting for the leader's challenge is the brain also craves autonomy. So here's an interesting balance, and I think it's one of the critical challenges of any leader. It's how do you provide enough certainty for people, and yet still give them the autonomy. How do you tell them we're going around the mountain on the left side, but you don't tell them how much weight to carry in their backpacks, what kind of boots they have to wear, what kind of equipment they have to take? And everybody's different on this scale, and everybody changes as they develop. So when you're a first-year PwC graduate, you need a lot more certainty than you need autonomy. And for some of us like me, I'm off the charts on autonomy requirements. That's why I always have to go independent after a couple of years of corporate, because I'm like, get me out of here. So I'm somebody that just has to have extreme amounts of autonomy. Otherwise, my amygdala hijack goes off. And I don't actually like certainty. I'm very unusual that way. I thrive in ambiguity. I would imagine some of you really enjoy the aspect of ambiguity as well. It'd be interesting. Getting more ambiguous in our world, I would say. But that's something. Now, the next one is we're tribal animals. We thrive when we're in tribes. We thrive when we know we're in tribes. So if our boss asks such and such out and doesn't ask us out, we feel like we're left out. If we don't feel like we're part of the commercial lines tribe, and they're all going out for drinks and haven't invited me, I feel like there's something missing. And I need to feel like I'm part of a tribe. And it's interesting, there's a couple neuroscientists that married Matt Lieberman in UCLA and Naomi Eisenberger, his wife, do some amazing work. In fact, their book, Matt's book, has just been published. It's really great to read, called Social. That's it, one word, Social. And they do some research where they get selected subjects and you sit in a functional MRI that's kind of watching your brain, and you're playing this kind of ball game, electronic game, with two other people. So I'm playing with, let's say, Jenny, and I'll play with, how do you say? So I'm playing with you guys, and then all of a sudden you guys play the game, and you don't pass the ball to me. And even that stupid little electronic game sends an amygdala hijack. You can see it on the brain. So you can imagine what's happening at work all the time when you don't feel like you're part of some tribe. And I guarantee, because I watch myself all the time, I can catch myself all the time, why wasn't I invited to the executive blah, blah, blah? Or why wasn't I? I should have been in that meeting. And you can see it all the time. We're very tribal. We want to be part of the tribe. We want to be in the inside of the penguin circle. Because once you get on the outside of the penguin circle, you're dead. So that is, we're driven for that. And the last part of the SCARF model is fairness. So I'll do anything. So let's see. Is it Sasha?
Yes.
Sasha, I'm going to give you $1,000. Okay? So the deal is you can keep $1,000 if Lewis, you have to give him a certain amount. He has to agree, and then both of you can keep the amount. So how much are you going to give him?
I have to give him an amount.
Any amount.
What? I'm going to give him $1.
Do you
have to? I think $9.99.
You don't get to choose. You have to either accept a dollar or not accept a dollar. Ah, now. So, why?
It's better than nothing. You can get nothing. She gave the money to me.
Exactly. So the pure economist sitting over there knows the answer is take the dollar, right? Because the dollar is better than zero. And even though you get $999, only if you get a dollar, it's likely on all studies that nobody will get anything in that scenario. Because fairness drives us nuts. And being at CBA in bonus time, dealing with a whole bunch of asset managers who are getting millions of dollars in bonus and who are still having a massive amygdala hijack because their colleague got more bonus than they are is just hilarious. I mean, kind of depressing, but hilarious. Fairness drive is nuts, and it's almost impossible to get it right. And it's really, really important for us not to be hijacked. We're constantly hijacked by this if we don't watch it. So let me take a pause here, and I'll get you guys to talk to a neighbor about what you see in your own workplaces around this model, and whether this plays out and whether it makes sense. And I might take some examples from people. So grab a couple minutes and talk to a neighbor that you don't know, introduce yourself, and say hello. I'm
autonomy, you know, say you have some autonomy but have it here and don't have it here.
You know, it's thank you for that. It's one of the, it is, I think, the challenge to leadership. I always use a metaphor of balcony and dance floor, because when you're managing people, it's like you're up on a balcony and you're watching the people and they're having a great time, they're all smoothly dancing, and then all of a sudden you see the waiter with the, seems appropriate tonight, but the waiter's with long glasses coming down, and you know they're going to, like, you know you get going to crash into them because you know they're not watching out for them. But you actually consciously make the choice sitting in the balcony, I'm going to let them crash into them, because they're going to learn when they do that, they're going to crash into it. So you make that choice. But then the next time you actually start seeing the chandelier in the light in the ceiling start to crack, and you go, actually, I can't just let this time to crack. I've actually got into action. I've got to come off the balcony and onto the dance floor and start to make things happen. It's always interesting, if, you know, where you allow mistakes to happen, where you allow failure to happen. Because failure is such an important part of learning, and we are not good learners in organizations. I'm very passionate about that. What else? What other people? What else do you think about? Yes, please.
Changes in the company, or sort of rounds of redundancy, or letting people go, and I think that response to uncertainty is incredibly clear. Then, when you know,
can't hear you.
Yeah.
Sorry.
the response to like that uncertainty is very clear in those situations where there's a lot of change happening. People sort of either shut down completely or go into this mode, which is really not at all productive.
Yeah, the redundancy. The redundancy situation is bad, and unfortunately for your generation, I think it's just part of you being. Mm-hmm. And for my generation, it just, I think we just began, just started to begin, and we certainly started to get to know it well in 2008. And I don't agree with how redundancy is done in most corporates. It's incredibly inhumane, and it causes unbelievable amount of death threat. Because in our society, life is our job, and so most of us aren't enlightened enough yet. I'm working on it to separate, you know, who I am apart from my job. And it's very, very disturbing. The mental health issues associated with regular redundancies of going to possess something going up. And we need a better way of doing this. Good example. Anybody else? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No. And in terms of fairness, for example, getting promotions.
Promotions.
It's actually interesting. So you'll look at, so people who've been in the company for a certain amount of time,
yeah,
others who haven't. So yeah. For example, with us, I mean, there's some of us who qualify very quickly, and others who don't, who qualify much at a much older age, right?
Yeah.
So you think if you're much older, then potentially you should get, you know, you should get a promotion because you've had these years of experience.
Yeah.
But a person might have been qualified, so they kind of on paper have the experience, and so, you know, maybe it's more fair to give them the promotion or the higher standard. So,
yeah,
kind of
you should enjoy it while you have it, because you're about, like in most of your age ranges, you're going to enjoy the most meritocracy you're ever going to enjoy. Because from here on in, it's just going to go downhill. Because politics starts to play an enormous role. One of the things I've done a lot over the years is done CEO succession advisory for boards and look at the way, help them make decisions on who the CEO should be and who the other people underneath the suite should be. And I can tell you, you'd be surprised, maybe some of you wouldn't be surprised, but you'd be surprised at the lack of precision in that decision making and the bias in those decisions that is quite unconscious. So quite interesting. So fairness. So what about this automatic response when we get triggered? Because we all get triggered. I get triggered all the time. I even know the theory backwards and forwards. If I were to say in psychology, and this is extremely simple, which is ridiculous, but here's a human being, what I can see about you is above the water, your perceived behavior. I can make judgments about the way I perceive your behavior. You can be aware of what you would like me to perceive underneath the water. You have some conscious intentions about how you want to come across. So you know that. But what's fascinating to me is we all have these subconscious core beliefs. And they're subconscious because we're not aware of them. They were there from the beginning. A lot of the social scientists and evolutionary psychologists are arguing some of it's in our DNA. Some of it was put in when we were in utero, even. But certainly from 0 to 7, big time for the have it argued that you laid down your circuitry in your brain and how you perceive the world and what made the decisions about the way you see life, and that really drives you. And what's interesting is it comes up all the time and you're just not aware. So I call that subconscious core beliefs. And if we were to keep this really simple when we're reacting to fear-inducing situations, there's our automatic behaviors, which we can see, but underlying that are some core beliefs. Some of us are really driven by the need for attention and approval. Some of us are driven by the need for autonomy, which is often expressed as anger. And some of us are driven by the need for security, which is often expressed in fear. So if you combine 3 by 3, okay, you have some cuddly numbers, you get 9 different personalities, which is expressed in something called the Enneagram. Anybody familiar with the Enneagram? The Enneagram, you can get literally on many sites, you can actually do your own testing. It's a fascinating instrument. It's like a personality instrument, very similar to Myers-Briggs in some ways. And I think it has a lot of validity. I'm just showing you
one dimension, which is what happens when they're in distress. But there's a lot of strengths to these different personalities. And particularly, I am a romantic. And I happen to know that my signature stress response is I'm not a fighter. I will flee the situation. I'll get out of there. I'm a real conflict avoider. I do not like conflict. And I know the underlying need. I've done so much work. And I've got a really deep-seated need for approval. It's just, it eats at me. And I can feel it because I've done so much reflection and so much work over the years. So I kind of understand that, and it's useful that I understand that because I can feel it coming on when it starts happening, and I can make that conscious choice to say, am I dying? No, I'm not dying. It's just the old approval need. The approvalaholic. So if you look at that, you could probably see some of your response. But as you sit there responding, what is your typical stress response when you feel something inside you? So just quick, talk to one other person you haven't talked to. Just very quick, what's your quick stress response in a work situation? Just see if you can get it out to somebody else. Quick, off you go. Maybe whales do. I'm going to figure it out. But we have a pause button. And we have veto power. We can use that. We just don't a lot of time. And this guy is my hero in this. And his name is Viktor Frankl. He was a German psychiatrist that was during Metro Ford. And for me, he is an illustrative of somebody that suffered the worst stimuli that you could possibly imagine to mankind. He was put in the concentration camps. So he lost everything. He lost his work. He lost his family. He lost his friends. He lost his village. He lost everything. He was at a point, and he writes so beautifully about this, that he almost lost his body, his life. And he writes that the one freedom that can never be taken away from humans is the freedom to choose one's mindset to any stimulus, regardless of how bad it is. And he did that. That's how he survived the concentration camp. So one day he would just decide, I'm choosing joy. Another day he'd choose anger. Another day he'd choose curiosity. Another day he could choose boredom. And he would just completely interrupt whatever stimulus that was happening around him and just choose the mental state. And for me, that is an exquisite ability to choose to veto the stimulus that's coming in. And that was a serious life and death threat. Now, if he can do that, surely we can do that at QBE or CBA or wherever we are, PwC and all the other outcomes. So the leader's choice is, this is how I express it. We can see the saber-toothed tiger. We're wired to see it. We see it everywhere. It's not just in the car accident or the floods or the whatever. And we can have the amygdala hijack. And what we mostly do, because you don't see people having fist fights, and you don't see people running away. Like, I don't run away from a conflict if it's at work. But what you do see is a suppress. And you see this. So the person is chemically still having an amygdala hijack. Their blood is still going to their extremities. Their heart rate is still going up. Their blood pressure is still going up. And the scientists now say that so are their peoples. Their people might actually see, I don't know what you see there, but anyway, they might actually see a calm, cool, collected leader. But if the leader's chemistry is having an amygdala hijack, and you're following them, your body will be having the same thing. You're tapped in resonance, even though you don't even consciously know it. The stress is pervading, and it's pervasive. And it goes right through your company. I'm fascinated by the way that CEOs create a field in the way they are, and I work a lot with them not to go down this pathway because of the power they have in attracting their people. So the choice here is the pause button. It is false because you're in real. It's a kitty patch. And there's my pause. It looks so good on this anymore, but so the idea is to reappraise. It's not a life and death threat. So the last part of the talk I wanted to give was, well, how do you constantly get yourself to make choice three rather than choice two? And it's just something we don't have in our Western modern society right now, which is mind fitness or brain fitness. And if I said, okay, let's look at an encephaloelectrograph, which is EEG, and it's like where you see them putting all this stuff on people's brains, and it's just measuring the frequency that your brain is experiencing. And I'm being really simplistic here, so take this as very simplistic. It's not quite simplistic, but it'll get there. So beta brainwave state is the brainwave state you're going to be at when you're at work, doing your spreadsheets, doing your forecasts, doing your numbers. It's a fairly high frequency brainwave state, and as you go into an amygdala hijack, it gets really, really hyperfrequent. And that's what triggers the release of adrenaline and cortisol. And the adrenaline and cortisol signal that fight, flight, and fear response. It signals the body, send the blood, shunt the blood to the extremities, get the blood pressure up, get the higher heart rate up, I need blood at the extremities to make this action work. So beta brainwave, interesting state. We're mostly in a beta brainwave state when we're in that work thing. When we're trying to get to meetings, catch planes, get on email, constantly moving from there. You guys have entered the state of the alpha brainwave state, I can tell, but I can read. The daydream brainwave state. and it's a cool one. It's called the bridging brainwave state because it's, for example, well, it bridges the subconscious to the conscious. So for those of you who remember your dreams when you wake up, it's because the alpha is present. It helps you remember what you had going on subconsciously. I don't know why subconscious is down there, but to your conscious mind, because your gut, subconscious to your gut, to your mind, your conscious mind. So the alpha brainwave does that, but the alpha brainwave is really cool in the sense that it also triggers the natural production of serotonin as well. And serotonin, for those of you who know, is the basis of a lot of our, not all, but a lot of our antidepressants. And if we don't have enough alpha in our day, we don't make enough natural serotonin, in addition to all of the dietary, which is lecture number 2 or 3. But we're not in this state enough in the Western society, in business. And this is a problem. And this is causing a lot of the depression of not being in this state. Theta brainwave state is kind of cool. Theta brainwave state is out of the blue. It's called out of the blue brainwave. And it's that brainwave when you get a, aha, I got it. Where do you do your best thinking? Where do you get your best ideas? Where are you?
In the shower.
Shower! I am number one on the family feud, whatever that thing is. I think number one. That's fun. I just think at some point work should be showers and desks. Showers and desks. where else? Yeah, sure else. Everybody says showers. Where else do you get your best thoughts?
On the train.
On the train. Guaranteed you're going to start to be in a really theta, low frequency state. What else? Where
about meditation?
Meditation, yeah. Absolutely. Meditation, the more that you practice meditation, the more that you can willfully make your brain go down into a theta brainwave state. Anywhere else?
What about?
Run, yeah. Yep.
I was going to say so.
Yep, exercise. Because you're in that tranquil, low-frequency state, and the nice thing about this is it's actually creating a new type of neurotransmitter that's it's kind of like a glue that creates a connection that's never been there before. It suddenly makes a connection between here and here, and you go, ah! And it's a friend of mine is trying to build a boat that he's, it's not a manned boat, it's an unmanned boat, but he wants to sail it remotely from Sydney to Auckland. I don't know why, it's something about the 50s, I think. So he's taught himself all the woodwork, and he's done that. And now he's taught himself all the metalwork, and he's done the propeller shaft, and everything else like that on the lathe. And now he's teaching himself the solar technology and the GPS technology. And he knows that every time he gets stuck at something, he just needs to sleep on it. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, it'll go like that. And that is where theta is also rapid eye movement, wake, sleep. So those of you who keep notebooks, it's not a bad idea to keep a notebook by your bed if you have a tendency to wake up at sort of 3 o'clock in the morning and go, I got it. Or you were at a dentist 2 weeks later at a house, and you're reading a House and Garden magazine, and you're completely in theta brainwave, and you go, you know, that's what happens. That's where innovation happens. It doesn't happen in the beta brainwave state. So, you know, as much as we must be more innovative than our corporate values, it ain't going to happen in that state. And the most interesting state to me is the delta brainwave state. So, for those who like to read, Malcolm Gladwell is a good popularist writer. He wrote The Tipping Point. But he wrote another book called Blink. And Blink is all about intuition. And the delta brainwave state is the lowest frequency brainwave state. It's what we are when we're in deep sleep. That's really important because it triggers the release of growth hormones, and we all need growth hormones to correct the mistakes in the cell replication that occur during the day. And when we don't get enough, we get old. So the less sleep that you get in delta, the older and more rapidly old you get. that's important. Our kids really need this because they need it to grow. But what's more interesting about Delta in this regard for leaders is they're starting to do more research about, there's something about being in this state where empathy and there's some kind of connection you can get into and get when you're really in this state, you're really connecting to people in a way that not many people can. And I'm always interested when the Dalai Lama comes in to speak in Australia. He's just one of those people that is in this state constantly all through the day. And I'm always interested in talking to the business people that go and see him. And I ask them, so what did you think? And I'm always interested in their response. And they always go, wow, it's amazing. Oh, my gosh, it's amazing. And even the most, you know, sort of dubious people, they go, it's amazing. And then I always ask, so what did he say? What did he say? And they never remember what he said. Because frankly, sometimes he kind of goes on randomly about different things, and he never really kind of, sometimes he does. But it's not what he said. It's the state that they felt themselves in, and they're in training with him. And that's the power that he has. And it's not a hypnotic trance. It's just that he's on that train, and he's on that sort of frequency, I guess you could say. And intuition is also where it happens.
Your point is that it's contagious to have that
faith. We're learning that it's contagious. And so those people whose religions or philosophies, for example, entail going to see the guru, one of the reasons they go to see the guru is to be up in that state, to reach that state, to entrain in that state. Because you really are, your brains are starting to get into that low frequency just by being in the presence of somebody that is already the depth of that. It's quite interesting. And when somebody's in a very, very high stress response, it's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Because we've dubbed them as leader, our brains are following the way their brains are. So it's becoming very interesting, this whole thing. We're much more connected than we think we are. Let's put it that way. So the Delta framework is fascinating to us. It's going to become more and more interesting. For those, anybody in the crazy golfer here or a tennis player, raise your hand. Come on, no tennis, no golf players? Tell me about that. What are you, tennis?
Golf.
Golf. Tell me about golf. When are you in the zone? What is it like?
The zone is when everything's just so easy and everything just clicks in, and you know, it's like a walk in a park, you know.
Yeah.
The sun's shining, and, you know, the grass is pretty green.
You're in that state.
Yeah.
My favorite game to watch on TV is tennis. I love watching tennis on TV because you can see the whole physique in the face of the person. As soon as they go out of the Delta, their game just goes. As soon as they're in the moment and they're in a really, really low frequency state, they're just playing like they're, you know, the Australian kid that got so far, that last game he won was just unbelievable. He was in that state. He was in that state when he was playing. And great artists, great athletes. Someday, great business people. We'll be in that state. This is of interest. But we know that that is in the zone. And it's a phenomenally interesting zone. The scientists can do studies on athletes. I think when they're in the zone. So the great cricket players, I do a lot of work on with Johnny Elms, who maybe you guys have one generation ago, but he was the rugby captain. And John needs to meditate before every game to get himself down into that state. And all the athletes are really beginning to understand the power of this. I just would love to see business do it. And we know the science is really starting to prove it out. This is Dr. Davidson at University of Wisconsin working with Machi Ricard, who's one of the most well sort of scientific Buddhists. And they're doing the research that a brain of somebody who's never meditated before compared to a brain of somebody that's meditated for 10,000 hours or more just looks very, very different. The colors represent all of the areas of empathy and intuition that are going off in his brain compared to somebody that's never lived it. And I'm coming to an end, so you guys know. I'm not going to go past that, but like I'm almost, I think I'm just eating out. But the science also says that we get ahas. If the aha is measured by the green line, the science says we can't get an aha in a beta brainwave state. We actually need an alpha peak, at least an alpha peak, if not a beta peak. before we get that new idea to emerge. So that has a big implication on how we set up innovation in companies and where we get new ideas. And you know, I don't know, like the shower thing is like far fetched. Two more slides. This one is Craig Hepson, who's a wonderful speaker. I've spoken with him a couple of times. He's a Dr. Craig Hepson at Monash University, and he works with all the he trains all the residents and interns. And he said that before he started working with them, 99% of them would experience, I don't know about 99%, maybe 99% of them would experience a serious case of depression sometime in their residency or their internship. And when they experienced that depression, they would be 6 times as likely to make a medication error, which I thought was interesting. So now I have a tendency to ask my resident how they're feeling. And it's a serious thing. And so he spent a lot of time thinking about how he does this. And so the education is about the brain. Because apparently the more we learn about our brain, the way it works, the more we can actually catch it in action and tell it to do something else. So he's finding that's working. Stress management, he's teaching them how to meditate, and it's working. Spirituality, you know, it's not any religion, it's just getting them to understand what meaning is, that's all. Meaning, what is their meaning? Exercise, really important. Nutrition, getting more and more important. Again, that's like lecture number 2 or lecture number 3. Our nutrition is woeful in our Western society. Even if you have what you think is a healthy diet, you don't understand that you've got a number of nutrients in our diet that are killing us. Connectedness to that tribal part and the environment being really, really healthy about what we do. So I'm going to end, and I'll be around for questions, but I'm going to end with this kind of concept for leadership, which is, anybody from South Africa?
Me.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yay, then
maybe you can pronounce it, because in South Africa, in the Natal tribe, in a way,
Selbona.
Okay. So my interpretation of Selbona is that when you greet somebody with that, you're saying, I can see you and all of your potential.
Yeah.
And when you're able to do that, it means that you're completely with that person. Your brain's not distracted about what you need to do next, what your status is, what your certainty is, what your autonomy is, whether you're part of the tribe or not part of the tribe, whether this is fair, you're just completely with that person, like in that tennis shot, completely present. And then a person then will respond to Kona, which says, thank you, because you see me and all my potential, I exist in the world today. And without that exchange, I didn't. And for me, that's pretty much the measurement of a big, bright leader and their connection. And the challenge I would give you is this, which is, and I've had him on my side forever and ever, I still think he's awesome. And even you can use it tonight, anybody you meet tonight in this lovely gathering could have the potential to be as interesting as Nelson Mandela would be had he come in to start talking to you. And if you go about life like that, the people that you work with, people that you lead, people that you meet on the street, it's a really curious life. You can't do it all the time. I try, but I like to do it all. I like to do it as much as I can, and it means that my mind's got to still, and I've got to teach my mind how to still to get there. And the last, for good actuaries, is the best quote I can leave you with is from the most famous manic depressive of all, I think, a known manic depressive. And it's interesting. I actually have to give honor to. Quite sad, actually, to Robin Williams that that he died today. And I think Robin was also a manic depressive. But this really sums it up all. It's a choice of your mind. And if you can remember Viktor Frankl in stressful situations, Winston Churchill kind of puts it nicely for us. And with that, I will turn it back over.